Good afternoon, and welcome to what I genuinely, thoroughly believe is the last of the weeks on Ezra. I actually have a spare sheet here. Anybody need the spare sheet, or you all have from what I put out? Okay, there you go. Okay, thank you. If someone could close the door, please. I know people are still going to come in, but thank you. Also, before we begin, I want to make sure that people know, although the flyers were out last week, about Nishmat's Women's Health and Halacha Day coming up this Sunday at the Bayit in Thornhill. For further... Okay. And for further information, I guess you could actually ask Michelle, ask Rebecca. I'm sure you have information. Okay, so last time round, we were on the separation of the couples who had intermarried, and we stopped in the middle of one particular passage that was strange, and I wanted to really treat it properly and not just race through it. It was in chapter 10, sentence 19. If you're using the Art Scroll Stone Tanakh, you want page 1837. We read through the Kohanim who separated, and we read through the Levium who separated. But in this sentence, we saw the statement Va'ashemim el sonal ashmasam, which sounds like what it's saying is those who were guilty brought a ram for their guilt, a ram karban, and the word that's used ashemim. Those who were guilty, is usually associated with what we call a korban asham. A korban asham is a version of sin offering. The usual sin offering is a chatat, and then there's also the asham. Just to, you know, to give that definition, you know, one step further, just to make sure it's a little more clear. Generally speaking, if someone violates a prohibition from the Torah, and they did it accidentally, sorry? And it was an accidental sin, then it's a karban chatas. It's a sin offering of the normal grade, so to speak. However, certain types of transgressions are unique. So, for example, if a person swore in vain, using God's name, swore not in the sense of a word they shouldn't use, but swore in the sense that they took a vow using God's name, and it was in vain, that would be a case in which they would bring this separate type of sin offering called an asham. And then there's a third variety called asham talui, which is in the event that I think I sinned, but I'm not sure, then I bring this korban called the asham talui. If I find out later that I really did sin, then I bring a chatat, then I bring the full-blown sin offering. So classic example, there were two pieces of meat on the table, one kosher, one non-kosher, and I picked one up and ate it, and then I realized, you know what, I'm not sure which one that was. Why did I have them on the table? Good question. Yeah. But that's the classic story. So that would be called an asham talui, literally a suspended asham, because it's suspended until I find out what the story is. It sort of suspends the guilt until I can resolve the situation. So the question here is, why are they bringing a korban at all? The Torah does not outline any sort of korban for the case of somebody who marries someone who is not Jewish. Yes, we did have the discussion about the prohibition, biblical versus rabbinic, but taking it as a biblical prohibition, it doesn't seem that it involves a korban at all, and if it does, it should be a chatat, it should be a basic sin offering, not this asham. So we saw last time the answer of the Talmud in Kritut, which, did I reproduce it on the source sheet? In source number one, again, referring you back to the verses in Vayikra and Leviticus, which we're not going to go through again, but that they had all lived with shifchot charufot. And as we noted, shifcha charufa, generally speaking, refers to a woman who is half shifcha, half maid, and half free. How could that happen? The simplest case would be that she had originally had her rights purchased by two partners, one of whom freed her. So now she's half and half. The same thing could happen to an Eved, to a male. Yes, it's bizarre. Yes, I don't want to go into the discussion of slavery in the Torah right now. As fun as that conversation is, it's not relevant right here. But the point is that if she is in this intermediate category and she is betrothed to a slave, to an Eved, and then lives with somebody else, that's shivcha harufa, and indeed the penalty is you bring an asham. The man has to bring an asham for having done so. So the Talmud says, oh, well, that explains everything. That's why they're bringing asham, because the women they married must have been shivcha harufa. That's what the Talmud says. Rashi doesn't give that answer. Rashi, in source number 2, said, haras shah haisa. The reason why they brought a carbon, you're right, it's not required. It has nothing to do with any law saying you need it, but it was a ruling for the moment. It was believed to be necessary at that moment. Ezra, who likes the grand gesture and does have korbanot, offerings brought at times when the Torah does not actually require it, he says, you know what? I'm going to institute this, even though it's not obligatory, and even though you're not supposed to bring a korban if you're not obligated in it. So it's an odd thing that they're doing. He says, I think this is necessary on this occasion. And that's the second answer. Yeah?
He's not a rabbi.
He's a super rabbi, Ezra. He's in Tanakh.
Yeah, but if you're he's a scribe, he's a Kohen, he's got legitimacy from the secular government.
Right.
But now he's interfering in a ruling.
Right. Well, let me ask you, in general, how does someone in Tanakh get depicted if they have the power to issue such a ruling? Who in Tanakh do we find with a description that shows, oh, this person could issue such a ruling? On what basis? Just because he's Moshe, right?
Talks
to God. So Devi gives one answer, which is often the answer in Tanakh, which is this person converses with God, what we call a Navi. And a Navi gets to do things that us mere mortals don't get to do. Yeah?
But leaders, whether they be kings or these are the leaders, judges, these are the people that make decrees for the community in all areas.
But is that really so? I mean, we've had kings who tried that and they got punished for it. We've had Kohanim who tried that and got punished for it, right?
I'm thinking of David moving the Aron, or you know, things like that.
Well, David doesn't move the Aron.
No, he doesn't.
Uzzah moves the Aron. David moving it from point A to point B.
Point A to point B.
Right.
Not touching it.
Right. Right. So I think the answer tends to be there is something called halacha, there's something called Jewish law, and there is something called an authority, and Tanakh doesn't really care to explain how it works other than to say that it's conveyed from teacher to student. So, for example, Moshe leans his hands on Yoshua, on Joshua, to confer his authority onto Joshua. That's a case in which we know that authority has actually been given to somebody to do Moshe-style things, which is to say, to teach Torah and present law to the nation. But beyond that, we aren't told about anyone's credentials to do it, as much as they are presented to us as doing it, and God seems okay with it. That's more or less the way we know it. So either you're a Navi, or you are one of these rabbis, and rabbi I use for lack of a better term, because really it's a late term compared to this. But you're somebody who has received this authority and indeed can play this game. And we're going to see Ezra do it throughout his career, meaning all through the book of Nehemiah. When Ezra pops up, he's going to do stuff like that, and later generations indeed perceive them as legal enactments, in some cases with applications for all generations. So Ezra is absolutely viewed that way. We talked about it a little bit when we introduced him in chapter 7 and 8, when I listed some of the takanot, some of the enactments that are credited to Ezra. So the problem we have here is just, why did Rashi not use the Gemara's answer? Right? As we read last week from Rabbi Yaakov Ellinger, the Aruch Lener, he said, I don't understand. He said, there's one thing that Ibn Ezra doesn't follow the Gemara. Ibn Ezra doesn't feel any need to follow the Gemara and its explanation of what appears in Tanakh. He goes his own way. But Rashi, generally speaking, will quote you the Gemara. So the answer, according to the Aruch Lener, is a fascinating answer. He comes up with this really interesting but entirely esoteric way to deal with this. And I wouldn't mention it at all, except that one of the points that he makes along the way is really, really important for us. So I'm going to take you down a little bit of a ride in this regard. There are two different types of Eved, two different types of slaves in the Torah. One is called Eved Ivri, a Jew who is sold as an Eved. Generally speaking, a Jew can only become an Eved if he steals and then can't pay for what he stole, or if he voluntarily sells himself, and he can be an Eved until 6 years have elapsed, and then that's it, he is freed. Then at the end of that period of time, he can choose to remain longer, but then at the Yovel, the Jubilee year, he automatically goes free. Whenever that occurs within his cycle, doesn't make a difference, he's freed and it's over. That's Eved Ivri. Separately, there's the law of Eved Kanani, which is that a non-Jew could be sold to somebody. And there the Torah says, you are not allowed to have an Eved Kanani, as is explained in the Gemara, you're not allowed to have an Eved Kanani, a non-Jew who is an Eved, unless the Eved of his own free will, or her own free will, says, I am willing to accept the practice of Judaism, and then in the event that they ever leave being an Eved, if they're ever freed, they actually undergo a complete conversion and they become Jewish. Those are the terms, Eved Ivri versus Eved Kanani. So Eved Kanani continues in Jewish history after the temple is destroyed. It's unclear exactly when it ends. Unfortunately, there were Jews who held slaves as late as the 19th century in North America. There were Jews who were in the slave trade. At that point, though, it's fairly commonly understood they're not following the laws of Eved Kanani. They're following the laws of, you know, North America. I mean, there's a lot to be said about Jewish involvement in that. Like, there's incredible material that's been discovered about that, including there was a shul in, I think it was Curacao, but I'm not 100% sure, which was dedicated to the children born from slaves and their masters. Yes, there was Jewish involvement heavily, unfortunately, in it, along with everybody else, because that was what they did. But they're not following the laws of Eved Kanani at that stage. At some point, Jews stopped doing that, and it's not exactly clear when. Eved Ivri, on the other hand, has a very clear delineation for when it stops. The laws of Eved Ivri depend on the law of Yovel, having this rule that every 50 years, all of them are liberated. Once that law stops, Eved Ivri stops. You can't have a Jew as an Eved. Well, then the question is, when did that stop? Well, the rule is that stops when Kol Yosheveha Aleha is no longer true, when you no longer have all the Jews living in their land. When was that? And that is the key debate. It depends on how you define all the Jews living in their land. What does that mean, all the Jews living in their land? So there are, surprise, multiple views. But one view, and the one that's germane for us, and that will bring us back towards what we've been talking about, is when you have representatives of each tribe in its historic tribal land. So when there are people from Binyamin living in Binyamin, there are people from Dan living in Dan, there are people from Yisachar living in Yisachar, and so on. That is the way in which Yovel is triggered. Clear? So what we're saying, in case it's not clear, is Eved Ivri is only relevant if you have representatives of each tribe in their tribal land. Tell me, do we have representatives of each tribe in its land at the beginning of the Second Temple? Absolutely not. Right? That we know. They're all living. Yeah. The 10 tribes are mostly gone. But aside from that, we know that the Jews at this stage are living in Yehuda and Binyamin. That's really where they are. The areas that aren't that far from Yerushalayim, in the central south part of the country. Not everywhere else. And therefore, says the Aruch Liner, and Malbim has this idea also, but I think Aruch Liner said it first, that's why Rashi doesn't say the Shivcha Harufa answer. Because Rashi believes Shivcha Harufa is this half and half slave, right, who is betrothed to an Eved Ivri, to a Jewish Eved. And Rashi believes there were no Jewish Abadim at this time, because you don't have Yovel. And that's why Rashi doesn't adopt this view in the Gemara. He says that view in the Gemara is a separate view within the view that Shivcha Harufa is with a non-Jewish Eved. Fine. Again, if you didn't follow all of that, don't worry. Nope, not at all. Except that I had a camp counselor once who had a t-shirt marking the Yovel, but I don't know how in the world they made that t-shirt.
This is kind of interesting.
One second, Susan is still...
I was told, I will see if I can, that in Israel, when it comes to certain things, they still do.
No, Shemitah we have. Shemitah we have, Yovel not. And the reason I say Yovel not is because Shemitah is easy. Because the way we hold regarding the count of Shemitah, the way we rule on Shemitah is just that it's every 7 years, and it's very straightforward, as opposed to Yovel, which requires a formal count. It requires a formal count by a Beit Din, and it's contingent on various rules in terms of figuring out when it started and when it stopped. It isn't an automatic count. Shemitah happens no matter what you're doing. Yovel is contingent on the rules being in place, so we wouldn't even have the first clue how to count Yovel. It wouldn't work. So the upshot for us, though, I'll come back to you in a moment, is that the Rashi doesn't go with the Gemara's view, because Rashi thinks that's within the view that the Shibcha Charufa can happen with Eved Kenani. Rashi doesn't believe that, and therefore he says that's not it. But what I wanted to make sure to draw your attention to is the concept of Kol Yosheveha Aleha. We talked about last year the sense of inferiority that comes to the Jews who are trying to build this temple, and how they try various ways to model it on what they had in the first temple, because that will show we're legitimate, we are authentic. One of the reasons why it's such a big deal is because there's a whole set of laws that are not biblically applicable for them. Not just Eved Ivri. This is, you know, for one law among several that apply when you don't have everybody in their land. So imagine now, you've come back, you have to imagine very hard. We have it in our own, you know, condition today in Israel. You've come back, you're settled, you're building the temple, but there's always this reminder, we don't have the tribes in their place, and therefore we don't have full, you know, the possibility to fully fulfill the laws of the Torah. And that's why I went through this entire path, was just to point out that issue. Yes?
I was just wondering, when you refer to most of the people being in terms of Binyamin and Yehuda, but the Gemara is repeatedly refers to Anshe Galil.
Right, and Galil in this case may just be the northern reaches of Binyamin. As opposed to, when you say Gemara, which Gemara do you mean, actually? Let me take a step back. Right, but that's, right, because you're much later than them. You're talking about the time of the Gemara. That's nearly 1,000 years by the time you get to the end of the Gemara after these events.
Right.
Yeah. I'm talking about Ezra's time.
Yeah.
In Ezra's time, they're localized.
Right. But in terms of, so the Anshe Galil, not necessarily in the original tribal.
Correct. Species. Correct.
Okay.
There is a much simpler answer for why Rashi doesn't say this, of course, and that it's Shibcha Charufa, and that's simply because it's really hard to believe that the 113 cases that we come up with where they have to separate are all married to Shibcha Charufa. It's kind of hard to say that. There are ways to deal with it, Rabbi Yaakov Emden deals with it, but I'm going to not take you too far into it. The other point that I'll make, though, the third explanation for why they're bringing the carbon, the first explanation for why they're bringing carbon is Shibcha Charufa. The second explanation for why they're bringing a carbon is it's simply Ezra's decision that this grand gesture is necessary. The third and last explanation is source number 3 on your sheet. A Mishnah in Kritot that talks about a voluntary asham. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer said, Misnadev Adam Asham Taloi Bechol Yom. He says, on any given day, you could go to the Beis HaMikdash and say, I want to bring this Asham Taloi, which is the type of carbon that's normally brought if you think you sinned, but you're not sure. So he says, you can show up any day you want and do that. Bechol Yom, Bechol Shasha Yirtze, any day, any time you like. That's called an asham of the pious. So there's a writer by the name of Shmuel HaKohen who wrote an article in a journal called Sinai, 73rd volume of Sinai, on this point. And he said that's what he thinks this was. He thinks it was simply, we feel guilty and therefore we want to bring this, and it's under the rubric of asham chasidim. That's the third possibility. However you slice it, they brought karbanot when they separated. And 113 couples separated. We read the Kohanim and Levim last time. Now we are up to chapter 10, sentence 25. again, on page 1837. And we are going to go through the list quickly. There are one or two names that I want to point out to you, but we're basically just going to gung through this list. We've discussed the question before of whether the people who intermarried were from the first batch of Jews who came, or whether they're from Ezra's group in chapter 8, or are they from the Jews, some remnant who remained after the exile? Jews actually remain in Yerushalayim. It's really hard to give any definitive answer except to say that the family names we're going to see here show up, most of them, in the first group who came with Zerubbabel, and some of them in the second group that came with Ezra. Not exclusively. There is no name that shows up only in Ezra's group. There are some family names that show up in Ezra's group and in Zerubbabel's group. The other thing that we're going to see is that these are the aristocracy. Of course, we already saw the beginning of this story, and we saw the nobles were intermarried. So we talked about way back when, about a year ago, when we read the list of people who ascended, and we said that some of these families become known because they brought the special wood, carbon of wood, every year to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, on a particular date. Those are the families that we're going to see here, who are married among the Canaanim. So let's take a look at sentence 25. Umi Yisrael, from Yisrael, as opposed to the Kohanim and Levim we already mentioned. Mibnei Parosh, the family of Parosh, that was one of those families that appeared in the first batch and in Ezra's group as well. They brought wood for the Beis HaMikdash every year on the 5th of Av and the 1st of Tevet. So here are the names. Ramya Yizia, Umalkia Miyamin Ve'elazar, Umalkia Uvnaya. And then the next one, Umibnei Elam, the family of Elam, which also is in the first list and Ezra's list. Matanya Zechariah Ve'chiel Ve'avdi Ve'remos Ve'eliyah, Eliyah being short for Eliyahu, of course, we've seen that in a few places. Umibnei Zatu, Zatu is one who's in the first list in the second chapter of Ezra. Elioenai, Eliashiv, Matanya, Viremos, Vizavad, Vaziza. You can see some of these names are recurring. They're evidently popular names. Tell them.
Just curious, in the top page, why is Melchi mentioned twice?
Yeah. In Pasuk.
The first Pasuk, top page. In Kay Parosh, you have Ramiya, Vizia, Melchi, Miyamin.
Yeah.
Or is Miyamin another name and different? No?
No, the answer had to be that there was more than one Malkiah in the family. I didn't even notice it as I was reading it, which is kind of scary. The answer has to be that there was more than one Malkiah within the family. Yeah, that's what you'd have to go with. Interesting. I didn't even notice it as I was going through. Okay, good. Thank you. Just want to see, because he has a footnote here. And he just says, Malkiah was a very common name. Shkoya. Okay. Okay. Yeah, he just said, Ubisofo shel pasuk ba'od Malkiah achad. Thank you. All right. No, they're not in the same family. I mean, they're part of the same. When we say family here, we mean a clan, correct? So, you know, there are first cousins with the same name. I have first cousins with the same name. Yeah, that's all. Umibnei Beivai. Umibnei Beivai, Beivai again, another one of these names that we've seen before. It's in Ezra's list and the earlier list. Yehochanan Chananya Zabai, good name, Aslai. And then Umibnei Bani, Bani apparently also is a Jewish name. Mishulam Maluch Va'adaya Yashuv Ushal Veramos. Umibnei Pachas Moav. Remember Pachas Moav when we saw that one? Pachas Moav, we said, was a very odd name. Literally means the ruler of Moav. Some suggested it was a descendant of David HaMelech, because he is the ruler and he came from Moav, because Rus was from Moav. Maybe. I would have a better explanation. Adna Uchlal Benaya Maaseya Matanya Betzalel Uvinui Umenashe. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31, Bnei Harim, also from Zerubbabel's list, Eliezer Yishia Malkia, very popular, Shmaya Shimon, Binyamin Maluch Shmaria, so that's all from the Harim family, Mibnei Hashum, Matnai Matata Zavad Elifelet, Yireimai Menashe Shimi, it's going to be the wrong period.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, Shimi has a name in Binyamin. You know, it is a name in Binyamin, but yeah, it'd be the wrong period in history. This would have to be a later Shimi. Mibnei Bani, here's another family with a Bani name. Dat Mikra suggests maybe it's one family that's split into two branches. Madai Amram Be'u'el Benaya Bedia Kiluhu Vanya Maremos El Yashiv Matanya Matnai V'ya'asai Uvani Uvinui Shimi. Well, this is a big family. V'shalem, maybe all families were big, but this one in particular had intermarried. V'shalem Yavina San Ba'adaya Machnadvai Shashai Sharai Azar El V'shalem Yahu Shmaria Shalom Amaria Yosef. Should practice these at home. Mibnei Nivo, Ye'iel Matisya Zavad Zivina Yadai, V'yoel Benaya. Kol Eile, last pasuk of this sentence 44, last pasuk in Ezra, as a matter of fact. Kol Eile Nasu Nashim Nochuyos, all of them married foreign women. V'yesh Mehem Nashim, they had women from them, or some of them. The other way to read it, some of the nations had nashim from ours, vayasimu banim, and they had kids. Okay, well, no chazak chazak, because it's all one book, as we're going to talk about when we open the Nehemiah section. It's all one book. But I have a couple of questions here. First of all, why did you list all the names? Shame, right? Why did you list all the names?
It must be because they were accepted as Jews. Because why else would we be here?
That who's accepted as Jews?
These aren't children.
These are the men who had married out. It doesn't tell me anything about it. Just the opposite. We find out explicitly, we said it earlier, that they did not keep them as Jews. They sent away the women and they sent away the children. So I would say the opposite, which is, it could be we list this for lineage purposes, to let everybody know, you know, if you see somebody, keep in mind the complexity of this. These are the days of polygamy, right? So one of these people has children from more than one wife. You want to know, so what's the story with these kids' status? Any name that you see on this list, you better investigate where are the kids from in order to know whether they are whether they're Jewish. I think that could be one answer.
It's all about yichus. Well,
yichus of the halachic variety, yeah. Not yichus of the I want to marry into that family variety. This is yichus of the I don't want to marry into that family variety.
And it still exists.
Yes. It could also be, you could take it in a different way. You could take it as praise to them for separating.
Oh yeah.
Especially because we're going to see a view that only the only 113. You made it sound like there was a nationwide epidemic. It's entirely possible that most of them did not separate, and these are being listed as these are actually the good guys. It's possible to read it that way, Alina. You were going to say?
No, I was saying it's relatively few compared to how many people actually were there at the time. I mean, 113 families.
Right.
Or men.
113 men, you know that you have at least 51,000, and odds are many more. Well, we don't know how many. Right, so I'm going to come back to that question in a minute, because I want to deal with that question properly. But just to give one other possible explanation for why we list them, is that it shows us that the families across the board are affected by this. Kohanim, Levium, Yisraelim, lead families, didn't matter. They're all affected by this. Debbie, what?
What do they do with these men? Shoot them? Like, what do you do with these?
No. No, are you kidding? Now they're available.
They reversionated. Okay, yeah.
I don't think that's a word. So the second question is the question that we've been pushing here. So did Ezra succeed? Did Ezra succeed in separating all of them? So Malvin believes yes. Malvin thinks Ezra did it. If you take a look on your sheet, source number 4. Malbim says, "Lefi ma shechashav achar kach shechishev achar kach shmoso anashim shenasu nashim nochrios." He says, based on this list of names that we then have of the men who had married foreign women, "Hayu ma'atim le'erach ha'am harav shayu atav eretz Yisrael." He says that's only a few compared to the size of the population. "Ubechol ze hayachid klali But the Malbim says it's still considered a national sin because it's done in public and the leaders don't protest. That's the way Malbim looks at it. So Malbim draws the conclusion that it was only this group and that they all separated and it's just made to be public because the leaders didn't prevent it and it was and therefore it's on everybody. He doesn't even necessarily believe the leaders had intermarried. He says the leaders didn't prevent it, as opposed to the way we read the sentence, which is the leaders did it. Debbie?
The legions of women, of course, they went away with their foreign husbands and lived in their households. We don't know about the numbers of them because they were...
We don't know. They left before.
Yeah, of course.
They left before. When they married their Kanani husband, they went to live among Kanan. Right.
Well, our point is that the numbers could be much, much larger.
Yes. I hear.
This is disenfranchised. Because this is just, now we're talking only about the guys, not the women.
Right, it's a good point.
The last few words of the comment of Ben Ezra.
Right, but he also continues to say that they weren't Makariv them because there were none there who were sincere. I read that, I think we had it in the source sheet a few weeks ago. Yeah, no, Ibn Ezra believes that they didn't actually do it. In other words, the option was there. But no one was of that position of wanting to do it wasn't a sincere conversion situation. I wanted to see if I have the exact reference in my notes, but I don't go back that far in the notes. Yeah. Yes.
Just in terms of the numbers, the fact that it says the Yesh Mehem Nashim sounds like they were the outliers, like this was not typical. There were also some women who intermarried.
Could be. It's possible. I can't prove one way or the other. I hear you, but I'm not sure. It could also be because we're not listing them. It just says, by the way, Yesh Mehem Nashim, without saying anything about the number. I'm not so sure. The Dad Mikra takes a different view. Malbim's view, again, is this is everybody, and they're all separated. Dad Mikra, Professor Zer Kavod, in source number 5, Nimtzeinu l'meidim shalo ala bidei Ezra lo tzias machshavto lepoal b'shlemut. He says, you see here that Ezra did not succeed in making this, in making his vision realized fully, ad sheba Nechemya v'hikshima v'koch shiltono, till Nechemya came and realized it with the power of his rule, because we're going to see this story all over again towards the end of the book of Nechemya. So you could say Malbim style, and it's just that there were new intermarriages after Ezra separated everybody, then they fell back into it. Or you could take the Dan Mikra approach, which I think is a reasonable approach, that this was actually something that was not solved by Ezra. And as you'll see, Nehemiah's tactics are not the same as those of Ezra. So is the nation behind Ezra at this point? Is the nation with Ezra? It's unclear.
If you follow the Malbi, yes. But if you follow the Stalin,
but not just that, right? We also had the question of how much support Ezra got from the officers. When we listed a few people and we said they were on board, was it only they were on board? Was it they were the ones who protested and others were on board? It's very unclear. And the reason why I stress this is not just because of Ezra, but also because it's going to be a theme in Nehemiah. We may even see a source on it today, that Nehemiah doesn't have everybody behind him either. And Nehemiah has people he's afraid of.
No.
Yeah.
We know that Ezra wrote Ezra.
Yes. Ezra gets credit for Ezra.
Right. So was he purposely vague? Like, he's writing it as a testimony. He wants us to read it in the future.
Yeah.
To write some of this, he has to be intelligent. No.
I would think.
So he knew what was vague. His reason could be because...
You mean the absence of a sentence saying we got rid of all of them? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but if he had done it, he would have said, he seems very proud. He would have said, I succeeded. I got rid of all the intermarriage.
I'm not sure the word proud fits.
All right, maybe...
No, meaning look at the way the story is... Look at the way the story ends.
That's true.
Correct. The story ends with, just physically ends because there's a last sentence, saying they married foreign women, there were some women who were married with them, and there were kids. It doesn't. There's nothing valedictory about this.
No, maybe developed a few. But he seems to be, if he's a historian, he would end it by telling us he succeeded.
And I think, first of all, he's not a historian. We made that point already from the beginning. This is not meant as a history book.
As a recording of what happened.
But I think the weird ending testifies to the fact that there isn't a sense of completeness here. This ain't over. And it supports, to me, the Dot Mikra perspective on it, that the job is not done, in fact. And now Nehemiah is going to show up, and we're going to start all over again. That's the way I would look at it. Moshe.
Can I ask you a question? And I apologize if I've missed this issue and you've dealt with it.
Okay.
It's just struck me that although we talked about these Nashim Nochriot, there's no mention about something seriously wrong there in the sense that we would find in the Torah. There's no Avodah Zarah. There's nothing like Baal Por, that's the story in Bamidbar. Is there some reason for that? They weren't Jewish, but there's no real offense that they're causing.
Other than the marriage itself.
Right. That's a very, very different story.
Right. So if you go back to Ezra chapter 9, no, because it's there. That's the thing. If you go back to Ezra chapter 9 and the sentences towards the end of the chapter in Ezra's speech about this, specifically sentences 13, well, even go earlier, 10 and 11, right? When he reacts with horror at the news that the Jews have married from those around them, he says specifically, where was it? Eretz nida ibn idas ameha aratzos pesavo sehem asher melua mipeh el pevetum asam. The toivah he's referring to is avodah zarah, is idolatry with which they have filled the land from end to end. And he continues in that vein towards the end of the speech when he calls them ameha toivos ha'eleh, the nations of these idolatries. In other words, it's the intermarriage. That's clearly what he responded to from the beginning, supporting the idea that the biblical text that says don't marry them includes, well, everybody, not only the seven originals. And then he puts in there this issue of idolatry they practice. The only thing we don't find, and maybe this is what you're getting at, is a statement of, when they report to Ezra, they say, people have been marrying there. They don't say, and they've also been sacrificing to fill in the blank God.
I just want to make another in addition to this point, which is that when we talk about intermarriage today,
yeah,
we'd be in great shape if this was what we had to deal with. Because intermarriage, we lose them. We lose so many of them. But here, all these Jews who are married out, they're Jews.
So
there's nothing here to say they left.
So you make me realize that there's actually a third possible explanation for the census here. Right? There's a third explanation. Tell me, what happens if Ezra decrees show up in 3 days? What's the or else? Not just their property. Huyibadel mikahal hagolah. They're separated from everybody else. In other words, it could be that the 113 are the people from that group who said, I still want to be part of the Jewish people, and they said, okay, the price is you have to separate, and they did. It's entirely possible that there are 5,000 more who said, see you later.
Well, leadership does a lot by way of propaganda. This has nothing to do with truth.
I understand.
The fact that he said you're going to lose your place in the congregation doesn't mean that a lot of them had already. It's just, it's just propaganda.
I mean, I don't think so. Given the fact that he has all the power in the world, he has the Persian army at his disposal, I think when he says you lose your property, he means you lose your property. This is not an empty threat.
No, I agree with you, but he can carry that out. But it's still propaganda from the point of view of what he says he's fighting.
Yeah, but that requires some evidence to the other side, right?
Let me just turn it around a little bit.
Are you trying to suggest they are worshipping idols, but it's excluded from the book for some advantage?
No.
That's what I'm missing.
That's my point. If you were me, then forget that image for a minute.
Okay.
Wouldn't you want something more? Wouldn't you want something more than, we call it Tuavotehen, which is really simply an echo of Exodus text. And elsewhere. Yeah, but it's not, the Baal Peor story in...
So I don't understand. Are you suggesting they are or are not worshipping idols? That's what I'm confused about.
I suggest they're doing nothing like that at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm suggesting that they were good Jews.
Okay. So what we've seen then in the last couple of Prakim, because the review of the book we did a couple of weeks ago, but in terms of this, is that, you know, word has come to Ezra that the leaders have intermarried, or maybe in that Malbim allowed intermarriage. Ezra is shocked, he grieves, he fasts. We talked about the origin of the prohibition against intermarriage. Does it apply here? Is it biblical? Is it rabbinic? The tendency to view it as biblical. The call from Shechaniah ben Yechiel to separate the intermarriages, the women and the children will not be converted, whether because no one would have converted sincerely, Alei ben Ezra, or because of the need to take a stand, we're not going to allow it now. Ezra combines the nation's power of creating law and his own power to enforce law into creating these social and financial penalties for those who won't cooperate. 113 named couples separate. The Jewish men bring karbanot, whether ritually obligated to, or special dispensation, or voluntary, however you read that. And some group among the people support this move, but it's not clear whether it's the majority of the population or not, and we don't know whether the majority of the intermarried couples separate or not. We don't have enough information. I do want to note one thing at the end of this book, which is, look how far they've come from the beginning of Ezra. In, for the good and for the maybe not so good. You've returned to the land, right? When the book started, any remnant of Jews that were around were you know, like the number of Jews living in Iraq today. You know, you're not talking about a real community in any sense. And now you have thousands and thousands of Jews. You built a Mizbeach. You built a Beis HaMikdash. You have your temple. You're conducting your rituals. You have a level of power within the community under Ezra, which is only going to grow under Nehemiah. You had problems as well. The intermarriage issues, the problems with the Samaritans, possible religious division among the nation over this intermarriage issue. I think it's really interesting to see the way they've evolved from the beginning of the book to this point. And to that point, I bring you a quote from the Nitziv. I have a problem with this quote, but I couldn't not bring it. Take a look, please, in source number 6. This is a letter written by Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. It's published in 1890. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin was the last head of the Volozhin Yeshiva. The Volozhin Yeshiva was the great yeshiva of the Lithuanian yeshivot in Europe over the period from the end of the 18th century until the Holocaust. This was supposed to be for the elite of the elite. It wasn't like, let's teach the rank and file, anybody who wants to come. It was, let's teach those who will be the teachers for everybody else. So Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Nitziv, was a fascinating figure. On the one hand, he's part of that line, and the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva. And then on the other hand, he's extremely, I think the best word is humanitarian, in his approaches to the Torah and to the way people should live as Jews. Meaning, he has a few comments in his commentary to Chumash where he talks about the importance of letting everybody approach Torah and mitzvot in terms of what appeals to them. So he says, you need to find what resonates with you, not to the extent of saying, and then drop everything else. But he says, you'll specialize in what resonates with you, and then everything around that will be you know, the side aspect of your Judaism. It is not for nothing that one of his main students, perhaps his best known student, was Rav Kook. That's correct. So the Nitziv's relationship with Zionism went in two different ways. For anyone who read Toronto Torah this past week, you saw articles on it in this past week's Toronto Torah. That's why it's fresh in my mind. On the one hand, there was a movement within the yeshiva to align with the Chovevei Tzion, the people who wanted to make Aliyah, start colonies in the land at the end of the 19th century. And when he found out about it, he fined the people who were in that movement. He did not recognize it as an official movement. At the same time, when Chovei Tzion came to him and asked him to be an advisor for them, he said yes. He served as an advisor for the early Chovei Tzion. So it's a very mixed identity. So keep that in mind as you read source number 6, which is a letter that he wrote regarding working with the secular pioneers. He says, "Ukmo shehaya bimei Ezra ha-sofer, as was in the days of Ezra the scribe, shekibetz Eza alafim b'Bavel mikol sugei bnei Adam. He gathered thousands from Babel, from all types of people. Gedolei Torah v'yirei Hashem, giants of Torah, people who revered God. V'gam yosam ha'anashim nosei nashim nochriyos. And the men who married foreign women, asher hayu mugalim b'chilul Shabbat, who regularly violated Shabbos." You didn't see that yet. That's coming in Nehemiah. "V'lo yadu es ha'Torah klal, people who didn't know Torah at all. All of them gathered together and prepared the settlement of the land in cities, such that eventually the land was filled with their children. Kain aleinu lahakitz lekol ritzon Hashem hanishma mikitzei haolam ve'ad katzeyu b'chol makom asher acheinu mefuzarim." He says that's our responsibility, to be alert to the call of the desire of God heard from one end of the world to the other, wherever our brethren are scattered, nidachim v'ne'enim, where they are banished, where they are tortured, lasos mashubi adenu hein ma'at o harbe, to do whatever we can, a little or a lot, uv'chol sugei b'nei Yisrael v'chulei v'al kulam yikuyam devar Ezra Sofer Bizmano, Yad Elokeinu Al Kol Mevakshav Letova. Regarding all of these people working together from all the different varieties, we will see Ezra's statement fulfilled, his message fulfilled, that the hand of God is upon all who seek him to benefit. So he says, Ezra took everybody together, we should take everybody together. What's my problem with this beautiful quote? Why can't I just leave well enough alone? What's the problem? Well, he accepted them, but each lineage was identified separately, number one. Number two, when he brought them out of Babel, he had no idea that he was bringing people who would intermarry. It was very clear in the text. He's horrified to find out that they've intermarried, and fundamentally, when they did intermarry, he said, go away. So, it's a beautiful idea. I'm not so sure about the Ezra connection. But it's a beautiful idea anyway, and a nice way to conclude Ezra. And now we'll turn the page on and start Nehemiah.